as a lead into our time of deepening into stillness, I offer you these words by Mary Oliver. It's called Sunrise. You can die for it, an idea, or the world. People have done so brilliantly, letting their small bodies be bound to the stake, creating an unforgettable fury of light. But this morning, climbing the familiar hills in the familiar fabric of dawn, I thought of the ways to enter. I thought of China and India and Europe. And I thought how the sun blazes for everyone, just so joyfully as it rises under the lashes of my own eyes. And I thought, I am so many. What is my name? What is the name of the deep breath I would take over and over for all of us? Call it whatever you want. It is happiness. It is another one. Fire. Let us now sit together in silence and stillness for a moment. I'd now like to invite Diana Ellis up and welcome you. I'm so glad you're here.
Pleasure to be here with you. When Don and I walked in today, Rob came up to us, or somebody with Rob, and said, I saw you walking down the street and thought, you guys look like Unitarians. And I thought, is it the gate? So maybe it's the gate. I'm not used to this little microphone. Is it okay? Is it all right? Okay, all right then. So what I'm going to talk about with you today is some insights that I've gained in my work, volunteer work as a Suzuki elder. And we call this particular talk and the work that we do with the youth as a Suzuki elder, What Moves Me. And I want to tell you that the Suzuki elders are a voluntary group of self-identified elders working with and through the David Suzuki Foundation, which is now 25 years old. And as you may or may not know, the foundation's purpose is to collaborate with Canadians. I'm reading this from their website. From all walks of life, including government and business, to conserve our environment and find solutions that will create a sustainable Canada through science-based research, education, and policy work. You may not know that Suzuki Foundation is not actually an activist organization. It is a registered charity, and it does science-based research. Really good, solid work. And the elders are embedded within the communications and public engagement division of the foundation. We've got about 100 members throughout Canada. And we have a little bit of funding from the foundation, and we have a little bit of staff support. We have a 16-member council, which I have the honor of being the chair of right now. And the core of our Suzuki Elders purpose statement is this: we mentor, encourage, and support other elders and the younger generations in dialogue and action on the environment. So our key words there are mentor, encourage, and support. And for the past 3 years, we've put quite a bit of energy into making specific links with youth. We've had forums, we've had workshops, we go on marches with them. We've had a couple of different projects intergenerational storytelling projects. And we've learned a few things along the way about working with them and about our role as Suzuki elders in engaging with them. And I want to share some thoughts with you about this and link it to resilience, which is your month's worship topic here at Beacon. So to start, I want you to tuck this quote into your mind. It's from a young person attending our 2013 Elder Youth Environment Conference. And this person said, "I'm actually scared about the future. Scared we won't have enough time to fix this. But when I attend events like this, I get hopeful." So we Suzuki elders ask ourselves always, what is our reason for working with youth on any given project or initiative? Does it fit with our purpose to motivate, encourage, and support? When working with youth, we quell our own personal desires to be heard out there in the public world, because in this case, we aren't looking for the podium for ourselves. We're reaching out to bridge that generational divide. And if we're audacious enough to think that we should speak on behalf of children and youth, we question what our motivation is in doing so. Is it because we can reach an audience that they cannot? Is that useful? And does what we say reflect how youth feel? Our work, again, with youth is to mentor, support, and encourage. And we remind ourselves that as elders, we are not their school teachers. We're not their parents. In most cases, we're not even their grandparents. We don't teach. We don't direct. We don't chastise. We don't hold out expectations. As we were reminded by a young man at one of our planning sessions, I want a way to think about things rather than what to think. So we elders remind ourselves of the truism also that no one can empower anybody else. People can only empower themselves. But what we can do as elders is help create opportunities for youth to empower themselves. That's an important differentiation there between, a lot of people think that, you know, you can empower another person. I learned long ago in the women's movement, you can't empower anyone else. But you can create those opportunities that people can take to empower themselves. And we've learned as Suzuki elders that our work with youth is not about us, it's about them. So what we bring to the table is really simple. We bring our story, and we bring our ability to reflect and describe on what I call the long view. Some people call it wisdom. I don't call it wisdom, I just call it the long view, the ability to look back. And we've learned that youth do want to hear our stories about our lives and what we've done and those long view reflections. And we've learned that these stories are best shared in some activity and context. For example, when organizing a workshop together, we don't say how something should be done. Instead, we might tell an I remember when story and illustrate how we did something and how a particular problem was solved. Teachable moments are not always obvious. In fact, Perhaps the best teachable moments are the ones we never realized were teachable at all. We've also learned our experience in planning and evaluation can be brought forward in the detail work, the don't forget about list, and we offer some assistance in making that list. And importantly, most importantly, we remember to be patient. Youth are busy and preoccupied with other interests, not the least of which is their own schooling. They don't respond to our emails as quickly as needed. As a matter of fact, a lot of them have moved beyond emailing. They're onto Facebook, and we've got to remember that. So consistent, patient elder prompting is required. And we've learned that the youth are fearless in the way we were all fearless when we were younger. You remember? Maybe some of us still have those moments of fearlessness. It's powerful. Some examples, some quotes I'll give you. One young person I remember at one of our retreats, we had eight young people come and talk to us about their thoughts about the environment. And one young woman said, "In terms of doing something about the environment, I thought, if not me, who else is going to do it? So I'm going to stand up and do it." Another young woman, just an amazing person, she said, "Well, by grade 10, I was going to rallies. I was doing flash mobs. Then I began to realize how important politics is to change. So I got involved in a youth action group, and I made a film on climate action." The youth we work with on environment and sustainability matters, they're bright and they're quick and they know a lot about the topic and from angles that often differ from ours. It's outside the box thinking and it's exciting to go there with them. One young person at the retreat said, "I've always found the root of the problems of the world is the environment. Always," she said. "And I want people to see that interrelationship of social justice and the environment." Another one said, "I think that environmentalism needs to be seen as necessary and enriching, not just a duty. Unless and until we think of it that way, there'll just be a small group of people working on it." Another kid said, "I think there's a stigma around the term environmentalism. I prefer the term sustainability." And we elders are also mindful of the different realities because of our age difference. I remember this young fellow said quite vehemently at one of our planning sessions, "I don't want to go to workshops when someone stands up and talks for an hour, and then I have to go home and remember what was said. I want to talk. I want to interact. I want to have some hands-on experience. I want to go home with some tangible learning." And another person at our retreat said again quite strongly, and this has stuck with me equally strongly. She's looked at us all and she said, "You know, the future is mine, not yours. The future is mine, not yours." We've learned that dealing with hope and fear and despair also play a part in this work with youth. The youth we engage with on environment and sustainability always want to talk about hope, and they want to talk about it first. I remember one young woman saying to me when I said, "You know, this is serious stuff," and she said, "But we got to talk about the hope." She said, "Let's make sure we talk about the hope." So we find that closing discussions and conferences and workshops and talks on a theme of practical hopefulness is more likely to lead to action and to personal commitment, as well as to gaining a sense of comfort and inclusion. The fears emerge further on, sometimes with a bit of gentle prompting. And the times when youth confide their fears about the future to us are important and moving moments of discussion. "I feel hopeful," said one, "when I see lots of people marching in the street. Makes me know there are others working on this and makes me feel less alone." Another one said, "My fears are that the issues will disempower us." And another person said, "I feel like we, the youth of today, have lots of worries already. Adding one other worry regarding the environment is an extra, and youth don't have the personal resources to deal with that worry." Indeed, just like adults, some youth do not have the resources to deal with those extra worries, or their resources are fragile. We know of young people depressed about the future. We know of some in despair. And this concerns us deeply and makes us review the way we as Suzuki elders talk with youth about the environment and sustainability, the way ahead, adaptation. We know that reality must be acknowledged, and we can't paint a rosy picture of the future, and we believe it's our responsibility to speak truth. We've always framed these truth tellings in a way that doesn't leave people, especially the youth, without hope. In a long discussion about this at one of our recent meetings, one of our elders said, "It's not so much about what we say, but it's how well we listen to the youth." And another noted that by our own example, perhaps we show there is hopefulness in action. We've learned that when it comes to knowing what moves us forward and what holds us back, youth and elders actually share quite similar thoughts. An interesting part of our workshops, and we did one last week actually, just down the road at the Quay at New Westminster, with a group of 20 youth from the Metro Vancouver Youth Sustainability Network, we asked them to describe how their fears and hopes about sustainability both move them forward or hold them back. It's a really neat discussion. It's really interesting to see the patterns emerge. And listen to what these youth told us about what holds them back from acting on their concerns. And see if anything here resonates for you. And I'll just read these quotes one after the other. The realization that I'm the only one trying to change something in the world. The unwillingness of others to help out. Seeing other people not doing anything. My age, I'm never taken seriously. Doubting how much I can actually do as an individual. Inaction by our leaders. The fear of no support and no results. I worry that I don't have enough passion. My own lack of time, distractions, social pressures to thrive in the economy and spend all my time making my own life better. And here's what they tell us helps move them forward into action. Hope, being inspired, my own growing awareness, and a lot talk about nature, the beauty of nature. I want to be able to enjoy it for the rest of my life. And about animals, I want all animals to exist and not become extinct. A desire to see humanity live on after I'm gone. A 17-year-old said that. Seeing other youth doing things, super peers. Seeing pollution and the environmental problems for myself, seeing the effect on others. And many talked about feeling hopeful and being moved forward into action by the possibility of creating sustainable systems. And when we reviewed all of these, we elders found that they weren't much different from our own motivations. So maybe not so much a generation gap. So what do these youth and we elders get from intergenerational environmental work together? For the youth, because the elders ask them for their perspective, working with us provides them with an opportunity to practice, to test themselves, to show leadership, to get on the podium, to shine. And because we've worked with them, we're able, when asked, to provide letters of reference. And perhaps most importantly, youth know that we will listen, that we will hear them, and that we have their backs. For the elders, we're reminded of the richness and privilege of working with the younger generation. Our knowledge and skills are valued by them, and this valuation is as important for us as it is for youth. The tech support, my God, the tech support that they share with us is much needed and extraordinarily useful. Finally, and this is no small thing, from the commitment and curiosity of youth, we receive infusions of hope and inspiration. We are helping each other practice resilience. Before closing, I've got a couple more threads to offer as we weave this tapestry of resilience and as we better understand what moves us and, speaking personally, what moved me. Dr. Suzanne Moser is an American scientist who has written a chapter in a wonderful book called The Handbook of Environmental Leadership. And her chapter is called Getting Real About It, Meeting the Psychological and Social Demands of a World in Distress. And she says, quote, the public and elected leaders do not yet grasp the seriousness and urgency of the situation, or in the absence of not knowing what to do, they choose to focus on more pleasant topics. Or as we well know, people get stuck in the dichotomy of environment versus the economy. She goes on, it is in this world that some have chosen to be environmental leaders. And what is asked of these leaders? To be steward, shepherd, arbiter, crisis manager, grief counselor, future builder. It's all of these, she said. And to do this complex and indeed spiritual work, future leaders need not to just be experts in climate change or a particular environmental field, but be capable of holding that which is happening to and in our world, to mentor, to guide and assist people in processing losses, human distress, constant crises, and the seemingly endless need to remain engaged in the task of maintaining, restoring, rebuilding, despite all setbacks, a viable planet. The only place the human species calls home. And while holding that vision, leaders must resist their own and help others avoid that knee-jerk response of ideological hardening, defensiveness, and blame. That, to me, is about resilience. And it's not just for so-called global leaders. It's for all of us. And my last thread is an excerpt from Canadian award-winning journalist Alana Mitchell's book, Seasick, The Global Ocean in Crisis. That was a book that helped me find my way into this work with the Suzuki Elders. I was reading the book in 2010, and just at the point I was going to close it, and it's a really good book, and I was going to close it in absolute hopelessness, she ended this stunning reveal of the global ocean crisis by talking about what any of us can do about it. And she spoke of the transformation that needs to happen for personal action to take place, affirming that transformation is possible and always begins with ourselves. She says this: we need to strip ourselves down psychologically and figure out what we stand for. What is the story about the world that makes sense to us emotionally? What is it that we believe? What are we here for? What am I here for? And once we know that, we can start to ask the right questions, including, what's missing in my story? Answering that question leads to a course of personal action, and that was an exercise in resilience. Reading and thinking on that moved me, helped me bend up and over from one place in my world to another, shifted me into working on sustainability and the environment, with the vehicle being the Suzuki Elders and the foundation. And I think it's really important for me anyway, to remember that our personal action can be wide-ranging, really wide-ranging, from remembering our cloth bags, remembering to take it out of the car when we go into the grocery store, right on up to civil disobedience. The climate change we're experiencing now is big, very big. It's overwhelming. And we elders know from our life experience in other movements, peace, anti-poverty, Occupy, civil rights, women's, anti-nuclear, any of those ringing bells for you? That every effort counts. Every effort counts, be it small or large, individual or collective. It all matters. So when people, older and younger, ask, and they ask this of us often, so what's enough? How do we make change? We're too small. No one else is interested. How can my small voice make a difference? How can I get others to act? What we say back, especially to the youth, is this: that every day we each do what we can, small or large, on that day, to move the environmental and sustainability agenda forward. Calling upon our resilience to do that. Thank you.
I thank Diana for her wonderfully inspiring and informative words. And I don't want to be redundant, but I have one more thing to say. One more word. One more. Well, maybe a couple. To be a people of resistance. To be a people of resilience. I'm going to focus on resilience. What does that mean? To be a people of resilience. I used to think it meant that you did it all by yourself. Right? Stiff upper lip, stand up straight, take the blows, come back. That is not what being a people of resilience means. And it's not the question. What does it mean to be a people of resilience? It means that you are a community together. And as Diana spoke, the community of elders and youth who share the same concerns for our future existence. I would suggest it also means that we're wise enough to know that we need to be able to share our fears and our pain, our sense of being overwhelmed, and that this in itself is a strength. It means that we are a people who can drop the false expectation that we have it all together and that we don't need any help or friendship or love or compassion. It means we can tell each other when we have those times when we are afraid, times when we perhaps don't like ourselves very much or ashamed of what we have done, our own weakness. It means that we can share times of kindness and receive it back, times of forgiveness and share it. It means that we derive strength from acknowledging our weakness, not alone, but together. And therefore, we all become stronger. We become a people of resilience. In our Soul Matters groups, for example, when someone shares honestly and authentically about something that they are feeling overwhelmed by, for example, something that they are grieving, it is as if they have jumped into the river and said to the rest of us, come on in, it's okay. We'll keep our heads up together. Maybe we can help each other swim. This is being a people of resilience. We are stronger together. I want to finish with some words. You may have heard them from you may have heard them before from the Hopi Nation. And I thank the writer for their words and inspiration. The river in this writing is a metaphor for our lives. There is a river now flowing very fast. It is so great and so swift that there are those who will be afraid, who will try to hold on to the shore. They are being torn apart and will suffer greatly. Know that the river has its own destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore, push off into the middle of the river and keep our heads above the water. And I say, see who is there with you and celebrate. At this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment that we do, our spiritual growth and journey come to a halt. The time of the lone wolf is over. Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and from your vocabulary. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. For we are the ones we have been waiting for. So be it.